Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we break down the Critics' Choice winners. We review Cherry, and Craig Brewer from Coming to America 2 is our guest.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 156 of Real Blend, a podcast that wants to know, hey, Kevin, did you know the alternate title that Tim Burton had for Edward Scissorhands?
I don't know that, Sean, but I'm ready for you to deliver this line to me.
Jake, do you know?
I quit.
The Rider Cut with the Winona Rider.
No, wait, that doesn't make any sense.
No, that makes sense. It's just not funny.
Winona Ryder.
But Ryder didn't direct?
No. Winona Ryder. Edward Scissorhands.
No, the show's starting off great.
Damn it! Can we start over? My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director, editor.
I still don't get it.
Here at Cinema Blend. It's the Ryder. She's Winona Ryder.
It rhymes with Snyder, and she's in the
Ryder
movie.
Ryder cut.
And his hands cut things.
And his hands, scissor hands. Edward Scissorhands.
But she doesn't have scissors in the...
The Ryder cut.
I thought there was I was looking for like a Burton joke because it was the director. I was confused.
Nope. The best jokes are the ones you have to explain.
This is going really well. This is going really well.
On this week's show, we're going to discuss the Critics' Choice winners. We are going to give our reviews of Joe and Anthony Russo's film Cherry, starring Tom Holland. And we have an interview with Coming to America, director Craig Brewer. And it is spoiler-filled, so we'll talk about that when we get a little bit to it. And by we, I mean Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev.
Hey, Sean. Jake. Gabe.
Good to be with you.
That was such an enthusiastic wave.
And Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jake.
Hi, buddy.
Jake's got his murder cup today, so no, I hope you're watching us.
It's a red rum mug, but if you're watching us on Zoom, it flips the image, and so ironically, it turns my red rum mug into a murder mug.
Jake, where did you get that mug?
I got this from the hotel from Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, is that really the hotel where Dumb and Dumber was shot?
Yeah.
I forgot about that. The Stanley. You guys got to look up Jake's package. And by that, I mean his video package on YouTube.
Weird episode.
this one's kind of off the rails already. If you are watching us on YouTube, hello. Thank you for watching our visual aspect of the show. Hit subscribe. Turn on your notifications. Every time we post a new video, you guys will be able to come over and watch it. You'll be able to watch Craig Brewer sitting down with Kevin and I, and he tells an amazing story about James Earl Jones and Eddie Murphy.
That's so crazy.
Filming their scenes together. But we will save that for Craig Brewer. If you're listening to us where you get your audio podcast needs met, please go over and go to the description down below. It'll tell you where to go to YouTube. It'll also tell you how you can sign up for our Real Blend premium episodes, which we do every single week, and we drop them on Monday. Get your ad-free versions of the podcast, an extra segment, and then a newsletter that I do every other Friday. You can go to bit.ly /Real Blend Premium. Did you unsubscribe?
I don't think I ever subscribed.
We should automatically subscribe.
You would think
as a host,
you
should.
I'd pump my own money into this show?
They are entertaining reads. And a lot of times they have like questions that people can play along with as well too. I make a movie of the week recommendation in each of them too. So yeah, you're missing out, Jake.
Well, to your credit, and I know I give you a hard time a lot, but I think people are really just now realizing this after diving into your book. You're a hell of a writer, sir.
I hope that they're now realizing that. Some people are regretting their decision to put down some money on my book. No, I'm kidding. This weekly poll. Oh, this is going to be a fun one. All right, so we started a conversation on the premium episode, and I'll just come out and say I lost. It's fine. We wanted to settle the most iconic piece of music composed by John Williams, and we broke it down by franchises. Essentially, we put Star Wars, Superman, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Other. Kevin, do you know which one won of those? Star Wars, Superman, Raiders, or Other?
I'm going to guess Star Wars, just because of our audience.
Star Wars dominated. 64.3%. At least I got second place, because I put myself out there saying that I thought Superman was his most iconic.
My favorite part is that people chimed in and said that Superman shouldn't have even been an option.
That's ridiculous.
Jaws had a much better right to be an option than Superman. If one of the four options had to be Other, and we had to name three, Jaws should have taken the place of Superman.
Jaws should have taken the place of Raiders.
No.
If that's the case.
No, sir.
You guys don't understand how iconic the Superman theme is.
I think I understand to a percentage. Exactly how iconic
Superman is. Iconic it is, but you said it was the most iconic John Williams score. Which
It's not even in the top three.
The difference in this argument is that we're not saying the Superman theme isn't iconic.
Right.
We're arguing with you that it's not his most iconic. It's not even his top 10 most iconic.
I would say top 10.
You know what
has to be top 10.
It's not top 5.
Okay.
About this poll that I'm surprised about, I would think that with such a vague option like Other, with so much work from John Williams, that wouldn't be... It came in last place.
Yeah.
That there wouldn't be a bunch of others that just got all of those votes.
Well, I think Sean and I kind of set this narrative of arguing on social media.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was basically, honestly, I think it was basically like the fight between Star Wars versus Superman.
Very true.
And then I think people kind of forgot, even though I do think most people would agree that Raiders is more iconic than Superman, I think the battle online became Star Wars. I mean, like, Sean even tried to cheat by bringing the Snyder Cut movement over to help him out. And even the Snyder Cut movement was basically like, dude, it's Star Wars.
Yeah,
betrayed.
A lot of them came out
Quite sure, like, how that was going to help your case, because John Williams' Superman score, aside from being used very softly in Man of Steel, doesn't really have anything to do with...
They're DC fans. They're just DC fans in general, and many of them.
But are they fans of like Dick Donner's Superman movies, or are they fans of Snyder Superman movies?
Yeah, I didn't realize you were on a first name Dick Donner basis with Sir Richard Donner. Just throwing it around like that. The other one that I think that we left off, which was somewhat embarrassingly, is Jurassic Park. Like Jurassic Park probably should have been on this list.
Jurassic Park.
He's got too many.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
To that end, like, I am kind of stunned that Other didn't do better. Like,
yeah,
Other probably should have done.
People
Became an argument between... It became, like, Jake versus Sean, and Jake won.
It kind of shows how much fun this audience has, and shows how geeky our listeners are. When we go technical, like, when we get into, like, a composer or cinematographer or some such, we get a lot of really good interactions.
Well,
so.
One of the best interviews that we've had in recent memory is a result of Kevin, and it was Ludwig. And
yeah,
it was awesome. Because we got to ask the kinds of questions that we don't get at junkets, and ask the kind of like technical nerdy questions, and that was because Kevin tracked him down and brought him onto the show.
Yeah, he was
so
cool.
Kev, you don't think he's gonna get an Oscar nomination?
Ludwig? No, Ludwig will get nominated. We were talking about cinematographers earlier. I think the only major award that Tenet will get nominated for is probably score.
Okay.
Yeah,
such a bummer.
He feels like one of those composers that just other composers admire now.
Plus,
you know,
he won for Black Panther. He's in that Oscars circle. It got a Golden Globe nomination. It's a phenomenal score. People are listening to it outside of the film a lot. So I think it's made traction there. But the people don't like Tenet. We know that, like, just from a general overall perspective.
But the cinematography.
Oh, it's
like, no, the red and the blue.
There, listen, there's no question. I mean, listen, we all know it's an amazing film, but I mean, Christopher Nolan deserves a Best Director nomination, but he's not going to get one. He deserves a Best Picture nomination. Not going to get one. So,
all right. Well, a lot of people this weekend caught up with Coming to America, the sequel that was several years in the making. And you guys actually both have fantastic interviews with Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall, the people need to check out on the YouTube page. And we got a chance to speak with Craig Brewer. And right off the bat, we kind of realized, oh, I guess this is going to be spoiler talk, because he started telling us some really great in-depth stories about the making of this film. And we had mentioned a couple of things that we had heard from Eddie about Tracy Morgan and his casting. And that just unleashed a sort of cavalcade of Coming to America spoilers. And so we held this for the week after. We told you guys to watch it in last week's episode. And so hopefully you checked out Coming to America and you can now dive right into our interview with Craig Brewer. If for whatever reason you haven't watched it yet and you want to skip ahead, there'll be timestamps that will let you guys know where to pick up with the show on the other side. This is a little bit melancholic to ask it this way, but as I was watching the movie, there were moments that felt to me like you were building up toward a crowd break, the way that Wesley gets introduced, you know, leading up to with all of his accomplishments and then him showing up on screen, or Morgan Freeman introducing Salt and Peppa. You know, I just knew that, like, on opening night, like, the crowd would be going crazy for all that. Were you editing, thinking about, you know, how this is going to play in front of a crowd?
Constantly. Yeah. I mean, it was when we were making the movie, like, the joy that I had watching Dolomite Is My Name with a packed house was like something that I hadn't experienced in a long time, you know, where people are shouting and screaming and cheering. And this is the movie that I knew that we were going to have that as well, because you're seeing people that you haven't seen in a long time. I mean, I even remember doing like this push in on Arsenio Hall the first time you see him, and I go, guys, we haven't seen Semi in more than 30 years. He gets the crane. Let's bring out the crane. You know, this is going to be a moment where like people will be like, oh, there's Arsenio. You know, it's funny. The more I started working on the movie during COVID, it changed. My feelings about it went through a real journey where I mourned the fact that we probably weren't going to be in a theater. And if we were going to be in a theater, it might be later, like years later, and maybe a diminished type of experience. Then to being, you know, a person who with my kids and my, you know, family, I would see these new premieres happening on Netflix or on Amazon or on Apple. And I'd get my family together and we'd watch, you know, Let Him Go with Kevin Costner. You know, we'd watch different movies that were premiering. And then I thought, like, man, they're, you know, after Borat, I was like, that was fun. That was fun. I think I needed Borat at that moment. And then I started thinking differently about Coming to America in this climate. And I started thinking like, well, maybe Craig, the heartbreak is now turning into something a little bit more hopeful. And maybe this could be where like you get grandma, you get your kids, everybody like makes their own, like, you know, Zamunda cupcakes or whatever they're going to make. And then they get together and have a good time with the family again, with the Coming to America family.
Yeah. Borat's a great comparison, because I honestly thought about that movie a lot watching your film and thinking about how they both seem to be coming at the right time. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Same with Barb and Star. We were talking about that the other day, how much we loved Barb and Star, which was really, really funny and kind of a comedy we needed. You know, Craig, I think what you've done from a technical standpoint, going into that barbershop again, is just incredible. And you think back to the original film in 1988 and what Rick Baker did with the effects, obviously, and it's truly amazing. I'm assuming technically those scenes probably weren't too much different to shoot, because it's still practical makeup. I'm assuming you have Eddie Murphy, you have multiple characters being played by the same actors and scenes, but you have this really cool oneer that kind of goes from the side as we're looking at everybody in the barbershop. And I wanted to ask specifically about the technical aspects of shooting a scene like that. What the one Eddie Murphy is looking at when the other Eddie Murphy is in the scene. Like, can you talk about just kind of constructing that and kind of, was it different technically?
I'll tell you, the great thing about y'all's, you know, about what you do with your website and with everything is that, you know, you really can give credit where it's due. And luckily I had an effects supervisor by the name of John Farhat, who's worked with Eddie before on a Dr. Doolittle. And I remember him saying, like, we need that shot that sells the world of the barbershop guys. And so every time I see that shot, as a matter of fact, there was a time where the editor, I think, cut the shot in half and did a reaction. And I was like, hold on now. You know, that John did a lot of work to make sure that this is all going to go in one. So I really want to give it up to him for that. But I will say that, you know, you've got your actors in makeup for 8 hours. And so, you know, you're then having to just really get to work. But it was particularly, I mean, I always tell the story that, you know, Kenya Barris was on set that day. And, you know, I mean, Kenya's, you know, not necessarily like, not much, I think, you know, phases him. He's not one to giggle, you know. But when Eddie and Arsenio and, you know, when Clarence and Morris and Sweets walked into an exact replica of the barbershop, we turned to each other. We just were like, we just totally turned into like teenagers, you know, just like giggling about this. And so it was a big day for everybody on the crew to see that shot.
But technically speaking, though, how do you achieve a shot? Like I always remember Nutty Professor, obviously, with the table. And I remember I was lucky enough to interview Eddie Murphy on a carpet for the Mark Twain Awards years ago. And he walked me through technically how they did it. It was a tennis ball to his left. He would shoot every scene.
John would place these tennis balls up, and then you would use what's called a motion control camera. So the camera is doing the exact same move over and over again. It's really difficult because that means that Eddie is in makeup as one character on the first day, and then you've got to duplicate that shot on the second day where Eddie's in a completely different character makeup, and he's got an earwig where he's hearing his dialogue that Clarence did the day before. So Eddie's essentially acting against himself with his own dialogue, but the timing of it is always like very difficult to do. And, you know, the same can be said with, you know, some of the de-aging shots that we were doing in the flashback sequences and a few other times in the movies. It's challenging, but when it works, it's very rewarding.
Seamless. Absolutely.
Yeah. Eddie told us during the press day we got him for a TV slot, and he had mentioned something to us that I had to ask you to follow up on. He said through multiple drafts early on, Tracy Morgan was going to play the son. And that they had to sort of, they couldn't marry the fact that Tracy was going to be Leslie's son.
There's even a bigger story. Okay, I'm always hesitant to bring up these stories. And then I hear that Eddie has said the story. And I feel like now the door is open. Because, you know, we talk about like the fact that, you know, I don't know if you know, but like James Earl Jones and Eddie and Arsenio and all those, they were never in the same room. You know, we have
really, like the bedroom sequence, like
never in the same room. Yeah, because I, as a matter of fact, I had to go to New York and film James Earl Jones.
Wow.
And I was Eddie and Arsenio all day. I acted all day with James Earl Jones. I was on camera dealing with him, and I never like to bring up these stories because it totally like it messes everybody up because they're like, oh god, it was so tender and everything, but like that's just what great acting is.
Wait, the funeral too?
They're not together. The funeral too. As a matter of fact, I get emotional every time I watch the funeral sequence because on the day I was there with James Earl Jones as he was talking to Eddie, as he, I'm sure this is coming out after the movie comes out. After he passes. And I couldn't help it. I mean, I was raised on Star Wars and Lion King and Claudine. And so I remember him, he's saying it to me, you know, he's not saying it to Eddie. And I couldn't call cut because my lip was quivering. I had a lump in my throat, but Tracy was supposed to be the son.
Okay.
And Eddie had talked to me about that a couple of times. And he would love to kind of do Tracy Morgan being the son, you know. He would do his impersonation. It was like, well, I got a father, you know. And it was funny right at the time. But then he gave me the script. And I said, Eddie, come on now, man. This isn't really going to work, I don't think. I mean, I love Tracy Morgan, but like, I think that what people want is they want to see a real representation of like who your son would be. That's kind of what everybody's going to be asking. Well, who's going to be the son of Eddie Murphy in this, sure. in this movie?
Yeah, it's a huge role. So it's a huge role.
It is. And so he goes, he'll play General Izzy. And I was like, okay, Eddie, here's another problem. So every time there was like an Eddie suggestion, I was in this really difficult position of like not liking it, right? And going like, well, here's my only problem with that is that I kind of want to believe that you're actually afraid of General Izzy. And I just don't know if Tracy necessarily brings any type of menace to anything. Yeah. And we had just done Dolomite is my name. And I said, Eddie, Wesley, and he was like, oh my God, Wesley would be great. So we immediately moved on to that. So we were working on the script and there was something kind of missing from the script. And Eddie just said, wait a minute. He needs an uncle. He needs Uncle Reem. Cause we had a cousin that was written in that role. And suddenly it was like, everything fell into place. And I was like, I know where you're going here, boss. Okay, you know who'd be really good as this Uncle Reem? And he goes, Tracy Morgan. that's the money right there. That's what we're going to do. And Tracy's awesome in it. Like, Tracy's really great in it. The yeah. moments between him and Arsenio, I could just watch them all day long.
That's so funny.
Very you know, funny. Craig, one of the things I found interesting, I revisited the first one recently, which is rated R, and yours is PG-13. And some of the bits in the first one, like, they use the F word, like when he goes outside of the building and he's, like, talking in New York and someone says F you to him. And, like, those are some funny moments. And I just wondered, like, were there R-rated versions of the script? What was absolutely. The decision process? Yeah,
no, we shot everything without any sort of, we would do, of course, we would do like TV versions, but we made a movie that was not necessarily bound by a rating. But it's funny because I noticed that, you know, I'm like everybody else. I'll look at Twitter and online and people going like, oh my God, what a travesty. You know, this movie's PG-13 and right. they've ruined it. But I would just argue that that's not really true. If you're really a fan of the first Coming to America, because
it's all about family, it's a grounded film. It's not.
It's kind of a fairy tale. It has yeah. like a little bit of this fairy tale theme, but the fairy tale element in the first movie that was so great was that Eddie's Akeem was very kind, innocent, and naive, gentle. But he came to Queens, and Queens was not, and he loved everything that was even awful about Queens, and that was the humor in it. Whereas Zamunda was kind of bookended, you know, of the movie, and now we've reversed it. Now Queens is kind of bookending Zamunda. And one thing that Eddie was always really big on is like, hey man, don't get like caught up in this crude thing, you know. And we just made Dolomite. We're not great and motherfuckers or what, you know. We laid into that shit, but now. You know, he was like, you know, just remember, you know, we want to capture that fairy tale feeling that was in the original movie. And so, the more we tested it, the more it just felt better in this pocket, you know, this was not some sort of cash grab, and definitely now that it's on Amazon, it isn't. So we haven't felt a desire to like, you know, filthy it up or anything like that, because it just didn't feel like it was the same movie. And I felt tonally we're still in the same world.
Like, even with Dolomite, even though it was R, it's the grounded nature of the emotion and the characters and the arcs that make these films so great. The comedy is funny because the drama's real. And I think that at the end of the day, Coming to America is about family, especially this one, considering his daughter's in the movie.
I'm very pleased that you mentioned that, because that was like the big thing that I was telling everybody. I was like, look, I was in high school when I saw the first Coming to America, and it was a big movie for me and my dad. Well, my dad isn't around anymore, but now I have like kids that are in high school, and I'm repeating that process now with them watching this movie. But how great that the narrative is about this as well. Like, Eddie himself in the movie, Akeem himself, is now a parent, and that's not what he was in the first movie. And just like every parent that wants their kids to be safe and wants there to be peace and everything like that, you know, you find that maybe some of the ideals that you had when you were like young, maybe have laxed a bit, and we need to like listen to our kids more. And so it was very important to me that those elements really ring strong in the movie. I mean, sometimes even there's moments in the movie, there's an argument between Akeem and Lisa that I remember people being kind of a little bit worried about. They're like, man, you know, Akeem kind of yells at Lisa here.
Oh yeah.
And, and be careful, you know, you want to keep him likable. And I was like, yeah, but you know, this is a scene where the wife needs to tell the husband that he's lost his way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those moments of dramatic weight, I think are just as important in a comedy as they would be in a drama.
Agreed.
Just to jump back to the original, we do have to all agree that Sam Jackson has one of the greatest F-bombs of all time.
Well, it can't be equaled. I think that's why we couldn't have him.
that is a Hall of Fame line delivery.
Over the years, you know, it's like, Sam, you know, you've kind of blunted your MF, you know. in 89, it was really cutting, you know.
We had Tim Story, the director, on the show yesterday, and he said something that really stuck with me, and I had to bring it up here to you. He was talking about his work on Shaft with Sam, actually. Yeah. And he said, guys, look, I didn't direct Sam Jackson. Like, I directed everything around him, essentially, you know, and to have my contributions. You worked with Eddie twice. Do you feel that way? Do you actually direct Eddie Murphy, like, especially in a Coming to America movie where he has such ownership over it? Like, what is your level of direction with him?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up in relation to Sam, because I know what Tim is saying. I mean, I'm sure Tim directed Sam. What it is that you're when you get Sam Jackson to be in your movie, you know, you want that Sam Jackson feel. And so Sam will give you like two takes, and damn it, it better be in focus, because he's going to give you really brilliant takes.
Yeah.
But I do have to say that I direct Eddie. Eddie and I, we meet in his trailer. We talk about the day. We talk about elements in the scene that we want to do, or maybe change. And then we go there onto the set, and I give him my thoughts, I remember the time that it was tested in Dolomite Is My Name. There was this moment that his character, Rudy Ray Moore, and everybody, they go to see this movie that's like that they just didn't like. It was just very boring, and they come out and they're out underneath the glowing marquee. And I told Eddie, I said, why don't you say this line and you come towards me, and then I want you to refer to this movie poster over there. I want you to walk over there, and then I want you to walk back and say this final line. And usually directors get this a lot from actors, like, well, why am I walking over there? And why am I coming back? I don't understand what the, and it was like the first time that I really had directed Eddie walking in a scene. Everything else, he was kind of standing there. And this was like that moment, that crucial moment, like, okay, new director with like an actor. And I was like, Eddie, I promise I will let you do whatever you want, but you've got to give me one take and let me show it to you. And so when he walked over there and he walked back, I slowly started dipping the camera down. So when he came up into the frame, all the marquee lights now were behind him, and him saying, I could be everywhere. I could be everywhere all at once. And I remember him coming over and watching it, and he was just looking at the screen, and then he just went, And then he walked away, and we went on with the scene, and there was never any question after that, which was nice. It was like we got each other's trust.
That's great. Craig, I'll end on this, because this is actually, I was lucky enough to do the press junket for this film and talk to Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy, and it was kind of an honor just to have both of those guys on screen together talking to them. And something I brought up to Eddie Murphy that I've always wanted to talk about is why comedy is never taken as seriously when it comes to the Oscars. And it really, really pisses me off, because I think that he should have won for Coming to America. He should have won for Nutty Professor. He definitely should have won for Dolomite. And I think Dolomite was another performance where, again, grounded emotional character that is made funnier because we care about his arc. And that theater scene you're talking about in Dolomite, when they're watching the film and they're looking around like, I don't see myself represented on screen. There was so much to be said in Dolomite. And I just find it interesting, because I genuinely think what Eddie Murphy does in Nutty Professor or this movie or Dolomite is harder than a lot of what we see from dramatic performances. And I wanted to ask your opinion. As somebody who's worked in this business, I've loved your work, Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. You've made some phenomenal films. Why do you think it's so hard for Oscar voters to go, that's good acting?
Well, it's funny, because I used to be an actor when I was in like junior high and high school, and then when I had graduated. And the easiest thing for a young actor to do is get mad. It's almost like that's why you went into drama in the first place. You wanted to have a scene where you could yell on the stage. It's so easy. And I would even say tears and sorrow is a close second, right? And the problem is that it's so large that people think, wow, I'm experiencing this fury, or I'm experiencing these tears, and therefore it's evoking this feeling in me. Therefore, that involved the most craft. Mm. And that is just not true. You take every like dramatic actor or actress and they will all say the same thing. Comedy is so much harder. There's no one in the room laughing. Everyone's got to be very quiet. You're dealing with timing with an audience who is not there. You know, and then you also have to get into like what Eddie is constantly in, which is like, okay, I'm going to be crazy funny, but I also have to be relatable, and I have to be someone that you kind of like believe that I actually live in this world, you know, and I'm of its rhythm. And it's just such a, I remember being a kid and watching Kevin Klein win Best Supporting Actor for A Fish Called Wanda. And it was a year where I saw all the movies, and it was kind of a shock that he won it. Yep. But that's kind of where I feel like the Academy members like place comedic performances. It's for supporting characters, you know, it's not for lead characters, which I think is just, it's really unfortunate, because I think that it involves so much more awareness and so much more craft at times, depending on the material, then sometimes some of these roles where people are kind of just screaming and yelling and doing things that feel right on a human level that are kind of easier to do.
Yeah, if the Academy actually saw the production of what went down on Nutty Professor table scene and doesn't think that was like some of the most brilliant acting they've ever seen in their life, I mean that it just blows my mind.
It really bothers me, especially, and I feel that it's even more stilted against Eddie. Because the problem that I think people have with Eddie is that they think that it's easy for him. I'm sure there are many things in Eddie's life that feels easy, but what people don't know is what I see, which is he's sitting in his chair, in makeup, he's putting on music, he's getting into a place, he's rehearsing these lines. You see him, he doesn't fool around on set. When you're in between takes, he goes to his chair, and you see him get into this trance where he is working and working and working. There's craft there. And I worry that people think that like, oh, well, Eddie's just showing up and being funny like he's always done. And that's just not true. Yes, he's showing up and being hilarious, but it's not like he's just flipping a switch and like, okay, well, here's what I'm doing today.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Craig, it's an honor having you on the show, man. And we could talk to you forever, but we really appreciate your time and continued success with the movie.
Thanks so much. Good to talk to
thanks,
you both.
Thanks for nerding out. Hustle and Flow is a masterpiece. It really is.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
We want to thank Craig Brewer so much for joining the show and sharing all that insight into the making of Coming to America. Thank you to Amazon, too, for giving us time with him. It was great to have him on Real Blend. Make sure you guys check out Coming to America on Amazon Studios. It's available for streaming right now.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Let's get to the talking points for this week. The Critics' Choice Awards. So the three of us are members of the Critics' Choice, used to be the Broadcast Film Critics Association. This was another one of the virtual ceremonies that were held. I am not, with all due respect to everybody at Critics' Choice, I think they worked really hard to put on an engaging show. I can't get into this award season. I'm having a really hard time just figuring out like what's going on with this award season.
How much of it is because all of the actors aren't in the same room together versus, because I think the Emmys did it really well, or maybe it was just the novelty of it. But with the Emmys, and no other show has seemed to do this, but like the whole Emmy bit of like every nominee had someone waiting outside their door with a trophy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. I don't know why no one else is doing that other than the fact that maybe they don't want to make trophies for everybody. But how much of it is the Zoom aspect of this award season versus the fact that none of us just really like the movies?
For me, it's both. For me, it's a little bit of there's a detached version of like, I think that, well, beyond the joy of us being able to go to Critics' Choice, which is something that I severely miss, and looking at the pictures of us at last year's Critics' Choice was heartbreaking because I really enjoy it. But I do think that some of the fun of it is how people play off speeches, you know, in the moment when they're in a room with their peers, people who are surprised to legitimately get up that way. The energy of the room, and you can't replicate the energy of the room. It's just been really hard at the Globes in particular, and now seeing Critics' Choice play out that way. But yeah, it goes without saying that it's weird that I don't love, you know, most of the nominees. I don't have a dog in the fight necessarily. I can't get super excited about a particular category. And that sort of came home to, although I was thrilled that Maria Bakalova got
I'm now like super into Best Supporting Actress. Like now I'm like all about wanting her to win.
Yeah. Kev, we gave our awards to Minari and Chloe. Does it seem like they are the front runners
Nomadland.
Now?
Nomadland.
Oh, not Minari. Nomadland. Sorry. Nomadland.
Oh, yeah. I think Nomadland is, I mean, it's one of those things at this point. It's just like Nomadland's best director. Chloe's going to be best director. I'm sorry. Best director for, yeah, best director and best picture are going to go that route, I think. And then they'll split the difference with actress. That's going to go to Carey Mulligan and or, I don't know.
Do you think Frances, or is she sort of playing herself out?
I think I haven't seen Frances McDormand winning anything yet. I mean, actually, right. I think the big tell is going to be the SAG Awards, right? Mm-hmm. But
Carrie didn't get nominated for the SAG.
Oh, she did?
Really?
Mm-mm.
That might. Well, then, yeah. Then wow. I have no idea. This award season doesn't make any sense then, because didn't Emerald Fennell not get a director nomination at the DGA?
She didn't get DGA. I think her best shot is screenplay. I think that's where she needs to. But also keep in mind, Nomadland, which granted, a majority of the movie is just Frances, but Nomadland isn't one of the top SAG nominees. So like that could end up going to Trial of Chicago 7.
Do you think because they're not screen actors?
I think so. I really do think, I mean, because when you think the whole point of SAG is like more of like an ensemble piece.
Right.
And maybe just because they don't really think of the actors who were the real life nomads outside of Frances and David as maybe they literally weren't SAG members. They have to be SAG members.
Emerald Fennell did get DGA.
Did she?
She did. Yeah.
Oh, I thought Jake Lee said she didn't.
Chloe Zhao, Emerald Fennell. I'm looking at it right now. Hold on. Where the heck did it go? It's Fincher. Sorkin.
What did she miss out on? She missed out on something big.
And Lee Isaac
Chung.
No, she got it.
Oh, then we're good.
You might still be in it. I don't know. It's an unusual ceremony. It's an unusual ceremony to try to pull off. I thought as a group, we ran into a problem with the NBA All-Star Game was on that night. And then the Oprah interview with Meghan and Harry, which just dominated ratings. Yeah. You know, like that was the huge topic of conversation. So how do you break through with an award show?
Yeah, but even the Globes only did 6 million. So it's not like, you know, we missed a giant opportunity to be a giant show. Like all the shows are down right now.
Yeah. What was it like doing the interviews backstage?
I had never done that before. I don't know if you guys have. I've never done the winner's press room. So basically it's just a giant Zoom like what you're in right now. And everyone's square is silent and they kind of announce. I kind of had my TV on across the room to see who the winners were. And they would announce, Maria Bakalova just won Best Supporting Actress. She's joining us now, and her video would pop up. And there's a little at this. I don't have it here, but in my Zoom box there, I would have a little raise hand button. It would let them know, hey, I have a question. and you would just sit there and hope that you would get called on. And if you got called on, they would unmute you, and then all of a sudden she would see you in that moment, and you would get a question. And, you know, and then, you know, some people would pop up and I would go, oh, I wouldn't really air this person. So I didn't raise my hand. And then there are a lot of people who say, you know, I raised my hand for, it didn't get, but I got very lucky in a night where I told my bosses, I don't know if I'm going to get anybody going into this virtual winner's press room. And said, look, let's not promote that I'm doing this because it could be a bust. And I remember this is a weird sentence. As I'm putting on makeup on Sunday afternoon, I thought, like, God, this is going to be such a waste. Like, if I am getting camera ready on a Sunday afternoon for nothing, like, I'm going to be annoyed by the end of the night. And by the end of the night, I ended up getting Maria Bakalova and Sacha Baron Cohen and Leslie Odom Jr. So by the end of the night, I was like, hey. And honestly, and I all award season, I've been trying to get Sacha Baron Cohen. So I was happy to have gotten a question. You only get one question.
Yeah.
And that's the thing too, is you don't know who's going to win. And then, like with Maria, I was the third of three people to, and the two questions I had written down for her that I scribbled down real quick once she won got asked by the first two people. So then they call my name and you just have to come up with a question in that moment, otherwise you waste your moment. So it was kind of exciting. It was fun.
That is a little nerve-wracking. It's a little red carpety for it.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the responsibilities that I have for Critics' Choice is helping out on the social media team that mm-hmm. evening. And so they put me in a pen in the back, and I get to be it's really honestly one of the best places to be.
Oh, you got some great pictures.
But you miss the show. You don't see the show at all. They don't have it on television backstage at all. And you just hear it happening on the stage. But every time somebody wins, they come off the stage and down a set of stairs, and they have an area where they first get their picture taken holding their Critics' Choice Awards, and it has a backdrop with the logo and sort of this fake artificial shrubbery type thing. And then there's a moment where they just are kind of like, okay, what do I do now? And, you know, a lot of times they have handlers, but other people are talking to them and taking pictures, and you're able to just sort of sneak around and talk to some people. And last year, that's where I got Quentin right after he had won for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We gave an icon award to Eddie Murphy. And after he got his picture taken, he was also just kind of standing around. I walked up, I was like, hey, Eddie, congratulations. And so it's a really cool place to be.
Because he didn't, you know, because sometimes a lot of the winners are like mingling with us while they're waiting to find out if they win. Eddie kind of just showed up, was backstage, came out, accepted his award, and then went backstage. Like he wasn't mingling around with us. So you had access that nobody had. Like that picture that you had with him that night, literally, I would say no one else that night got that picture.
That's awesome. That makes me really happy because I know how much that means to both of you guys.
Dick.
All right, let's get to our WandaVision wrap up. Jake and I have sort of vented about it on thing, but Kev, I never got you finishing it.
Oh,
did
yeah.
you finish it?
Yeah.
Where yeah, are you at with it. The? Oh wait, hold on. I'm sorry. What game?
I was just gonna let our audience be warned that we're gonna discuss WandaVision in full.
That sounds great. So if you want to stay unspoiled, skip to the next section, Kev. Where are you at with WandaVision?
The show just didn't do much for me. After episode 3, I thought the whole show went downhill, personally. Okay. It just didn't... there was something special about the first 3 episodes. I've said this before in the text chain. Entirely too much exposition and re-explaining of the entire MCU and having characters dumb down storylines that we already had learned about in the past 23 films. Performance-wise, everyone's fantastic. I mean, obviously, Bettany's amazing. Olsen's amazing. It's one of those things where I was watching it, and I finished the show, and I'm just like, cool. That was interesting. I mean, it's not Mandalorian level. Mandalorian is just worlds beyond WandaVision. No pun intended on that. It just genuinely is brilliant. Just from a storytelling standpoint, the cliffhangers are incredible. The payoffs are amazing. And at the same time, like, WandaVision is an interesting concept, right? Like, you know, the idea of a superhero. I mean, that's kind of what makes superhero movies so interesting, and is when you humanize them to a level where they can deal with an emotion that common people deal with, grief, elements like that. It humanizes people and humanizes characters. And to spend, was it 9 episodes? How many episodes mm-hmm. was it? Yeah, 9 episodes on essentially the grief of WandaVision and I guess
the Scarlet Witch transition specifically. I don't know. At the end of the day, I don't know what it accomplished other than she's sad about the passing of Vision, and now she's moved into this headspace, and now we're going to see her jump into this part of the MCU film-wise. So it was a lot of time spent on... Also, one of the things that really upset me about the show, and I don't know if this is just... this is such a trivial thing to bring up, but the show would end every week, and there was still 10 minutes left in the timeline, and then there was like 10 minutes of credits, and it has nothing to do with the product or the quality of the show overall, but like I felt like those run times were deceiving every single week. It was like, oh, your show is 37 minutes. Actually, it's actually 26 or whatever it was. And then it would run. And again, that's just a trivial thing. But mentally speaking, you would prepare for a 37-minute show and it would just end at like 26 or whatever. And I don't think that really means anything about like the quality of the programming. It just was a little deceiving, I thought.
But how could you guys say that about WandaVision? Because I know Jake agrees with you, and for people who weren't watching the YouTube channel, he was thumbs-upping and pumping his fist when The Mandalorian is simply, he picks up Baby Yoda, and he's got to deliver him to a Jedi, and at the end of it, he does.
No, see, it's so much more complicated than that. The Mandalorian also doesn't spend in half of its episodes of re-explaining Star Wars. You know what I mean? It doesn't re-explain the...
While it doesn't re-explain Star Wars, it's sort of monster a week story structure kind of makes each episode that doesn't tackle the larger story pretty meaningless. Not meaningless characters build, but like that was, I think all of us had that critique with The Mandalorian, though, was that the storytelling was that monster a week all too often versus getting us back to the really exciting main storyline.
Mm-hmm. Like the recurring element of like him having to do a task. Yes. To move forward in the mission.
He was doing side quests in a video game, the TV series.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, WandaVision to me was more interesting in the bubble. Out of the bubble, I did not find interesting. And I think the problem at the end of the day is that the writing on the outside was just so bad that it to me, it deflated how much I loved the inside of the of what Wanda, you know, Agatha, whatever you want to say. The scale of action was insane, though. Like the actual, like the Catherine Hahn. That's to me when I walk away from that show. Like that's the performance that I'm like, damn. Like I was like, oh my god. Like she really kind of dug into that character. I loved how evil she was. That switch between her, like in that zombie mode versus the, you know, her regular. You know, that was pretty well done. I'm not saying I hated the series. I just feel so lukewarm about it.
Jakey?
I take issue with, for people who did love it, saying that the only reason that people didn't like it is because their theories and expectations didn't come true.
Right.
I honestly, like, would it have been cool if, like, Doctor Strange had showed up? Like, sure, yeah, that would have been fine. But what I wanted and how I was kept my own friends and family watching the show when they were trying to bail was this is a study of loss and grief within the MCU, and I just didn't feel like it fulfilled that. That being said, I do think it's unfair to throw that criticism out about people being disappointed about fan theories not working out when your own actors are out there in the press basically trolling fans by kind of hinting that things are going to happen. And then when they don't happen, saying like, hey, why are you disappointed? We never promised you that. Like, that's a little unfair.
That's not the fault of the show.
No, Jake that's is the, saying it's that's what he's saying. Is the, that,
but
that's
it's the fault of the actors.
Yeah.
It is the fault of the actors.
But you can't blame it, but it's not the fans' fault.
They shouldn't have said that. Like, should they have not have said that? I totally agree. Like,
okay, but you can't. But the idea that it's the fans' fault that they were disappointed because their own theories didn't come true. Well, it's your actors who are out there fanning the flames of these theories. Well,
remember, Henry Cavill also stared me in the face and told me there was no Snyder Cut and he had no idea what the Snyder Cut
was. There's a difference between that and, oh, a cameo's coming that's bigger than Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, or like, oh, I get to work with an actor I've always wanted to work with, but it turns out to be me talking about myself. That slides into my issue.
That one was pretty funny. I mean, Paul Bettany, see, knowing Paul Bettany, not that I know him personally, but knowing how dry he is, just from a comedy perspective, that's pretty damn funny. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I thought about this the other day, actually. How many times do you think we've been lied to in interviews?
Oh, so many.
It's gotten to a point where, like, but the Henry Cavill thing was the one that really, like, put me onto, like, oh, we don't really realize that what people are telling us in these interviews could be complete bullshit. Like yeah. It's genuinely, like, I mean, like, Henry Cavill literally looked me in the face and told me he knew nothing about a Snyder Cut. Like, yeah. I mean, that was I believed him. I posted that interview, and like fans got mad at him for not supporting Snyder in the comments, knowing all along that he knew damn well. I think. I mean, I don't know for sure what Cavill knew, but Sean, at that point, he knew, right?
I would think he'd have to know because he had to have known what he filmed,
right?
And how it was drastically different than what showed up in theatrical.
Also, Cavill ended up being the one that helped him announce the release of it.
Yes.
You know, so at the end, yeah, but anyway, so...
Wait, let me drop a little mind-blowing thing on you guys. A friend of mine, very close friend of mine, who lives out in San Diego, came to the Critics' Choice Awards with me one year, several years ago. And he is currently reading my book. And he texted me and he said, hey, this reminds me of that time that we met Henry Cavill at the Critics' Choice Awards. And it was so long ago, it was right after Man of Steel. So it was like 2013, 2014 probably thing. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, that's right. I vaguely remember that. He goes, he was there with his date, that Haywire chick.
Yes.
Gina Carano.
Yeah.
He was dating Gina Carano and was her date at the Critics' Choice Awards.
I remember that vividly. I also remember, oh, I have a story about that night that I won't tell here, but it deals with Joss Whedon, but I won't dive into that now. But I think I know.
Yeah,
I remember that night vividly.
But I just completely blanked on the fact that like Henry Cavill was there with Gina Carano and was so like not the center of attention because she was nominated for like best action, you know, movie or some such that she was the focus that night and Henry Cavill was just hanging out as her date. I think the time he was talking to my friend, he was like holding her purse and hanging off to the side.
I was just about to tell you that, like, that I specifically remember Henry Cavill being extremely chivalrous that night. Like, he was like, that dude is a gentleman. Like I remember, and I specifically remember it. Like, I remember, like, I remember the Gina Carano element. I remember, like, him, like, being like essentially being like pulling her chair out for her, like things like that. He is classy. Dude.
I think I know what Joss Whedon's story is because I was there that
the conversation,
year too.
Yeah. Like I what he told me blew my mind so much that I couldn't believe it. But I'll tell you guys off air.
Please tell us off air. I really want to know that one.
It's not DCEU related, by the way, for people out there. This was like
this is long
2013
before.
Or something. Yeah, yeah this yeah. was like right after
Cabin
the
in the Woods.
Cabin in the Woods.
Like Cabin in the Woods.
That's why he was there. Him and Drew Goddard were at the show together. And I remember meeting Drew Goddard because I didn't really know who Goddard was at that point. But Lauren was all obsessed with Buffy, so she knew who Whedon was, and, you know.
Sean, did you want to take a moment to defend WandaVision while we're in the spoiler bubble?
I probably should get away from that, shouldn't I? It's top five MCU for me. I mean, it's just everything about it was tremendous. I loved everything about it. Back up, Jimmy.
Hold on. All right, let me clarify. Like,
yeah,
WandaVision, I feel like everything I said sounded relatively negative. I think at the end of the day, top five MCU, I'll explain to you why. It's like, dude, all right, wait. In that top five, you're talking like Infinity War, Endgame,
I consider
Winter
those
Soldier.
Two one.
Ah, you can't.
Oh, come on. No.
They're one.
How? Are we doing an opposite Kill Bill right now?
They're 1A and 1B.
No,
they're
not.
Essentially the same story. But even if you're going to make me take two spots, then fine. They are 1 and 2. Fine.
Okay.
This is the difference, and I'll keep this very 30
That's
seconds.
Two different
the difference
movies.
Between Kill Bill and Avengers is this. Yeah. Avengers stopped filming.
We've discussed this on the show.
I know.
Did it again.
Yes, I know.
Tarantino shot one movie.
Yes. But I'm saying, I totally understand that.
But Sean, get to your point about why it's top five for you.
I am blown away by the amount of stuff that I think that the show tried. I'm just talking about in show. I'm not talking about the teases and the fan interaction and all that. I'm talking about in show. They took two characters who most of us consider to be C-level characters and thoroughly made me care about their journey and their progress together. And by the comics, Wanda and Vision and their romance is a very significant story. And they figured out a way to do it in a long form series that I thought that they needed all of the beats to do. I loved the sitcom element, but I think the sitcom element lasted just enough time. Like, if it kept trying to force the sitcom element, I think it would have grown tired. I think you had to question why we were watching this. And then once they started to explain what was going on, then I really, really admire that. I thought because they had the time to develop their characters, because most often the time in these Avengers films, you're rushing through 15 characters at a given point, that Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany got a chance to do some of the best character work that I've seen in the MCU by far. I mean, Captain America and Robert Downey Jr. and Iron Man probably have the most evolution of their characters because they've had multiple chances to take a swing at them. But where these characters are from where I ever thought that they would be is mind-blowing to me. It introduced S.W.O.R.D., which is a significant contribution. It rearranged Vision and brought him back into the world in ways that are going to be really, really fascinating. It introduced witchcraft and introduced a new villain in Agatha and hinted at things such as Mephisto and I thought the multiverse, but maybe not. Do I think that they botched the Quicksilver thing? Yeah, probably, you know, but
the Quicksilver thing was bad.
It's bad.
I think I said this when that happened. I think that was, yes, we could read into, is this establishing that that's coming over? Or is this Kevin Feige planting a foot down and saying, those no longer exist here? This guy is cast in a role as Quicksilver, and it turns out to not to be Quicksilver. Don't expect that. Like, to me, that's like a, okay, well, I don't expect to see this multiverse thing that we're talking about necessarily.
Maybe. I mean, maybe, but I don't know.
That's a douchey way to say that.
It's kind of vague, if that's what he's trying to get at.
I think they meant it to be fun. I think they meant it to be fun.
And I couldn't overlook Kevin's right about the exposition. Like, as much as I wanted to defend it, like, in the back half of it, all the stuff outside of the hex was really bad. But for them taking their first stab at a long-form television series, I thought that they swung for a lot of big fences and accomplished a lot. I will gladly rewatch it multiple times, and I really dug it.
I can't get over the top five MCU thing. Hold on. So in that list, this is potentially ahead of what? Like Civil War, Winter Soldier kind of thing? Like Winter Soldier, I want to know your top five MCU.
If you're making those be two, then those are one and two.
Okay.
Civil War, Homecoming, Winter Soldier. And then I'd put WandaVision.
So not top five.
Him, it's they're one is what he, when he said originally.
Okay. But it's not one. So
I know,
not
but he
five.
Said top five.
Okay, but
even
if it's six, it's still, you're talking 24 movies and it's in the top half.
Dude,
of
it's them. It's bottom
you,
half for me.
You think it's better than the first
that.
Avengers, the movie?
Yes, I do.
Oh, no. The first Avengers movie was amazing.
Yeah, it is. So was WandaVision.
Oh, all right. What would you rather put on? The first Avengers or WandaVision?
Well, I mean, the first Avengers is like, you know, 90
two
minutes
and a half hours.
All right, I think WandaVision would have been a better movie than a TV show. I think you take
it wouldn't have
nine.
Had the same, it wouldn't have had the same impact, though.
I think it would have. I think you sort of set it up as a sitcom and make your audience go like, wait, what the hell? And then 30 minutes into the movie, you kind of start pulling out a little bit. And,
but it would just feel like another Marvel movie. Not that that's a bad thing, but it would just be another Marvel movie.
It ended up feeling like just another Marvel show.
I really enjoyed the week-to-week conversations that this triggered. I think that was
nothing
a lot of
sure.
fun for the Marvel community.
Yeah, that I love too. I just think the story, I just don't think that's a story that needed to be told over 9 weeks. I would love if shows went back to a week-to-week. I love the water cooler thing because I thought after Game of Thrones, the water cooler era was over.
Yeah, Mandalorian brought it back, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, to be able to like talk about the shows in between each week. But also, I think that WandaVision becomes a very interesting experiment because I think Marvel understands, I think, just based on the reaction to the series. I think it's a little bit more divided than we think. I think there were people on both sides of the fence on the show. But at the same time, there's no way that Kevin Feige isn't looking at the discourse and saying, okay, all right, maybe did the week to week affect expectations? Cause fans are looking. I saw a great tweet today that I thought was explained the entire fandom. And it was a foot on the top. It was Anthony Mackie. And it said, I know a thing or two.
And below, it was Anthony Mackie and the Thing from Fantastic Four saying, "The Thing confirmed for MCU." And it was like, it was basically like, just because he said a thing or two in, that Endgame? I think it was Endgame.
I think he says it in one of the Falcon Winter Soldier.
Okay. He says, I think, because I know a thing or two, and they took the word thing and made it seem like he was confirming that the Thing was going to be in Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
It's sad because there are some movie sites that would run with that. Absolutely. They would take that and run.
We know who they are.
Well, funny enough, I saw the tweet because somebody retweeted it, and like they even like it was like self-deprecatingly joked around that like this is kind of like the discourse of how we are now. But there's an element with the problem with Marvel is it's so secretive and so Easter eggy, if that makes sense, is that we're like almost, I actually think it's detrimental now to the storytelling, so much so that we can't even watch stuff without thinking about what it means outside of the film. And I think we've gotten to a point and that's kind of like the hard thing about where we are as a culture right now, is that like we're almost not really even enjoying what we're watching because we're always thinking about what does this mean again. And like I'll never, like with Infinity War, and I go back to this example all the time, like when the Infinity War ending happened, a lot of people said, "Oh, well, I know that Marvel has a deal coming up with this, and this person's going to be alive because they have a sequel coming out." Like the fact that we know that in our minds is just insane. Like I get that's where we are as a society, but it does really kind of hurt the actual viewing experience sometimes.
But is that where we are as a society, or is that just where the four of us are knowing this? I would argue
film
like
society. Sorry. I mean the film community.
I think a lot of film fans know way more than film fans ever knew. Not just because you guys read and cover it every day. I think a lot of people, especially Marvel fans, know all that stuff.
We were watching the Snyder Cut, and Michelle said to me about an hour into it,
Can we say that?
I think we can. I'm gonna say it. We've watched it.
Some people did it when they thought they were watching Tom and Jerry, so you know.
Yeah, that's fair. And we were an hour into it, and Michelle said to me, "Is Spider-Man in this one?" with all honesty.
Do you think Feige is looking at the discourse? Because I think it's fascinating, because when you do a week to week for a show like WandaVision, you are risking, and it did happen to a lot of people, disappointment from fans because of the buildup of what we think is coming based on an Easter egg, or you know, she put the Pop-Tart in the toaster the wrong way, so that means Pop-Tart Man's coming in the next episode. You know, just like little like stupid things, but like that's where we are though, and I wonder if that can be
this week's Real Blend Out of Context tweet.
Pop-Tart Man is coming.
I was just thinking of a random... to answer your question, Kevin, because I think it's a good question. I think that we have to think of this TV show as phase one Marvel TV in a big way of they're going to figure out how they want to tell stories this way, how the audience wants them to tell stories this way, but also we as the audience are going to figure out what these stories are. I think a lot of people come into this first Marvel thing that's happened in a year and we're expecting a Marvel movie event. And perhaps moving forward, the way I described WandaVision was it just felt like connective tissue that I really liked, exposition aside. But if all of these TV shows are just going to feel like connective tissue, then I think our expectations will shift and we'll go, okay, I'm going to hang out with these characters, but I don't need to expect Black Panther. You know,
see, is the MCU going to drop a big bomb in the show? They're not. Because you know what I mean? Like to Gabe's point, like you're not going to drop a bomb, like MCU bomb, in the middle of a TV series.
Maybe not. But it's only the first show, is my point.
True, but what I also find fascinating is this, and this is something I'm very interested in knowing. When we jump to the next, what's the next MCU film to be released?
Black Widow.
Black Widow, yeah.
Okay, I guess and then I don't know.
Shang-Chi. We ain't getting nothing in that.
I don't know if it applies
after that.
Oh, okay, well, Black Widow's a prequel, so what's the next forward motion story?
Shang-Chi in
before
July.
Eternals?
Yes, Eternals in November.
So my question is this. Will the viewer have to have seen WandaVision to continue with the MCU storyline that they're watching
in the movies? And I guess so there's a twofold answer to that question, because one, if they don't, that goes to Gabe's point. It was just connective tissue. If they do the shows like Falcon and the Winter Soldier and WandaVision become essential storytelling tools to move the films forward? So like if I go to see Infinity War and it ends, I need to go see Endgame to find out how it continues, right?
Yeah.
But if a show comes out in the middle of that, and then the Endgame's after that, do I need to have seen this show in the middle to connect to the story, or will I be able, or is Feige going to leave the movies kind of streamlined?
I think Doctor Strange is going to be the tell as to like how much we really need to watch. In fact, and I'm going to shamelessly plug my interview that I did. We interviewed Benedict Cumberbatch yesterday, and I asked him if he was aware that people thought he was going to be in it. And he kind of paused and he goes, oh, yeah, would have been in it. And then he kind of paused and he goes, well, like, especially like considering what happens with me and Lizzie and Doctor Strange 2, it would have been cool to be in WandaVision. Mm-hmm. So I think like Eternals, probably not. Black Widow, I would say definitely not. But I think the big tell of like how important WandaVision is will be Doctor Strange 2.
But what did WandaVision do emotionally?
Keep in mind, WandaVision wasn't even supposed to be the first one to come out, right? Wasn't the original schedule Falcon and Winter Soldier was supposed to be first?
Yes, and WandaVision was supposed to come out much closer to Doctor Strange 2 coming out. They should not be separated by this much.
I guess I just wonder, like, okay, so we know that Vision dies in Infinity War. You, we know she's upset.
Are you asking about the emotional impact of WandaVision? That's what you were
I'm
getting
trying
at?
To understand, like, what...
Have you rewatched... Have you rewatched Ultron or Civil War since you've watched it?
Not since the final episode, but I've watched them recently.
But since you started watching WandaVision, have you watched?
Yeah, we watched Ultron a couple weeks ago.
For me, I already felt a difference in their scenes in those older movies, having sat with the characters more. The scenes meant more to me than they ever have. Yeah.
I think her being the Scarlet Witch is a significant difference. Massive. Like, she's theoretically more powerful than the Sorcerer Supreme now, according to what
Is that the biggest thing that came out of the show?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nailed that look, nailed the costume.
Even if it's just the origin story for a character like the Scarlet Witch, and if the Scarlet Witch is going to become significant to the creation of mutants in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I think she is going to be, then you're going to need an origin story that warranted where this came from. And if it stems from the grief of her loss of Vision, great. I'm glad they took the time to explain that.
I feel like Marvel and Star Wars are now... they're in the business of moving forward, but they're also in the business of realizing things we didn't like in the past and creating new content that gives us no choice but to like it. And, you know, in the world of Star Wars, I think back to the plot hole that people pointed out in A New Hope for years, which is why would the Death Star have a hole that you could shoot in and blow it up? Like, that makes no sense. And they literally create an entire movie that explains...
Great movie.
That explains... why there is a hole in the Death Star. And you know, I wasn't a big fan of Age of Ultron, but now after WandaVision, you look back at Age of Ultron and go like, well, like, it's quintessential Marvel now. Like, it has to, you can't skip it when watching the Marvel films.
Jake, is Rogue One a top five Star Wars movie?
It's so tough because the last hour of Rogue One, I think, is some of the best Star Wars ever.
Yeah.
The first half of Rogue One is good. It's good, but it's nowhere near. So I don't know. It's tough because it's, you know,
They have a bad track record in general.
Rogue One has the best Vader scene of all time.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if at the end of Empire Strikes Back, though, like he revealed that and you were like, yeah, but it's not a big deal, though, because I know that in the next movie they're going to talk about the fact that like, he's not really his father.
So fascinated just because, you know, because Kevin and I and Gabe and I, we're all of the age where, like, we grew up and it was just a known fact. I'm so fascinated about that three-year gap between Empire and Jedi where people didn't know if he was telling the truth. I think that is fascinating.
That never crossed anyone's mind.
Right. See, I disagree because there's literally an episode of Big Bang Theory where Sheldon runs into James Earl Jones and says, like, you know, I thought Darth Vader was lying. And James Earl Jones goes, so did I. A lot of people tell me that was the debate. That was the fan debate over those years in between was he telling the truth?
Not in my circles.
The fan debates back then, you know, it was carrier pigeons. It was
rocks chiseling on caves, cave walls.
What it was. Yeah, they were like, "Oh my God, really? It's his father?" Okay, cool. We moved on to something else.
Let's go. Let's go.
Yeah. I'll see you in 3 years when the next thing.
How about that Superman score, though?
All right, fine. Let's get to this week in movies. Did either of you guys see Long Weekend? I caught up with Long Weekend. Did you guys see it?
No.
No? It's a Sony film. It is a very small indie. It is, I looked up the name of the girl, Zoe Chow, who's been in a couple of, she was a supporting character in a couple of films, Damon Wayans Jr., Casey Wilson, and the main guy is Finn Wittrock. It is a hard film to talk about because there's a hook, there's a twist in the middle of it. And if you don't talk about the twist, it's hard to talk about the film. But it's kind of like a indie rom-com. Guy meets a girl after a bad breakup. She is, and they make a joke about this, like she's the, what is that? That manic pixie dream girl type thing. Like everything about her is cool and he can't understand where she came from kind of thing. And they get to the explanation of where she came from. And it has there's an element to the story that once it's revealed, I wish they explored. And instead of exploring it, they just kept it being an indie romance. And I was like, oh, but you just dropped this cool bomb. Like, why don't you explore cool bomb?
Is it a bomb kind of like Palm Springs bomb? Like that level, like where they...
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Those kind of... Are we just going to get a whole subgenre of rom-coms that are like, but also...
Yes,
which is kind of cool.
Though this one's not comedy at all. It's definitely more heartfelt, indie. You know,
okay,
your feelings on your sleeve kind of thing. Okay. The two of them are adorable in it. They're a really great couple. I just wish it explored the more rem. It'd be like if Palm Springs revealed that bomb and then like ignored it for the rest of the movie. And you'd be like, really? You're just not going to go with it? That's a choice.
There's an arrow in your back.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's sweet, but it's hard to recommend. So anyone see Yes Day? Jennifer Garner's movie, Yes Day, on Netflix? She's sweet. I like her. I haven't seen it. I might throw that on. She's going in down the family route, you know, making all these lighthearted family films. And then Cherry. So Cherry, we talked about on an earlier episode. We said we were going to save it till this time. It is coming to Apple TV after being in theaters for a limited run. I thoroughly enjoyed Cherry. And I watched it a second time, too, to even prepare for the junket. And... you know, we make jokes about Tenet and how Tenet has a bad rap. Cherry was getting destroyed by critics. Did it ever come back around? It was in the 30s, I thought, on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's definitely rotten on Rotten Tomatoes, which not that is the end-all be-all when we've talked extensively about Rotten Tomatoes, but I was a little surprised whenever those initial reviews dropped at how ravaged both the film and Tom Holland's performance. Both of which I thought were, I'm with you. I feel like Cherry, my only knock on Cherry, and it's not even really a knock, it's just that it is so much.
Yeah.
A lot happens. That there's a part of me that wishes it was like a miniseries, like an HBO miniseries.
Well, the structure of Cherry is unusual because it's broken up into chapters, not unlike the Snyder Cut. And each one
which
is,
we may
each
or may
one
not
to
have
me,
seen.
Is a very distinct genre. Mm-hmm. It's, you know... First, it's a couple meets at college, essentially, and they're sort of young love. Then is the boot camp military, you know, movie.
Yeah.
And then it's the drug addiction heroin movie. And then it's the bank robber heist movie. And in each path along this journey, the Russos, to me, treat each one like a short film. You know, like, let's explore the trappings of each of these genres and do them to the way that we would want to do them. But I honestly think that it's Tom Holland and... Sierra Bravo. I think their two performances hold it together. Like, I was so invested in the two of them and their journey and their relationship holding it together that I didn't mind going through each of the different chapters with them. So I don't understand any kind of knock on it. I thought it was fantastic and absolutely think it's worth watching.
Agree. Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I loved it too. I thought it was incredible. Cinematography, score, performance. They even pull off a Children of Men wonder, which was really impressive, which I was really excited about.
What's the scene?
Keep an eye out for it. So basically, yeah. Well, so in Children of Men, for people who haven't seen it, there's like this incredible wonder where they're in the car with Julianne Moore and Chiwetel Ejiofor and Clive Owen. They're doing the ping pong ball back and forth, and there's like it's just the wonder as the it's like spinning around the car. The actors were having to duck as the camera went around, basically. Amazing. So if you watch Cherry, there's a they do the similar wonder. There's a scene where they're on the way to the bank, and they pick up two of their friends, and Tom Holland's in the passenger seat and the driver, and it starts out and goes in and then it spins around as they drive. It's pretty wild. So
also,
but that's Newton Thomas Siegel, who shot Usual Suspects Usual Suspects. He also shot Defy Bloods as well.
Wow.
Phenomenal DP. I think he shot Usual Suspects. Hopefully I'm right about that. Newton Thomas Siegel.
Friend of the show, friend of Real Blend, Chris Van Vliet has a part.
Yes, he does. He's right behind Tom Holland.
Yes,
in the scene
during a moment where Tom Holland is working in a restaurant and his ex is now with somebody else and they're trying to get a table at the restaurant. And I could not stop staring at Chris Van Vliet, who is a. I don't know how he ended up on that. I know that it's in Cleveland and he's from Cleveland and maybe the Russos know him that way, but. It's fun that he got down there. So
yeah. I want to spin off about his character. I want to know who that guy is.
But just shout out to the Russos. No, yeah. I just want to shout out to the Russos because like it's a lot of really cool technical filmmaking achievements that I do think are very important to the story and the storytelling, and they service the story. They're not just done for cool shots. Like I feel like Snyder falls into that same boat where he's very technically stylized, but everything about the technical stylization is important to the storytelling. So mm-hmm. for me, like Cherry was just an incredible look at PTSD, mental health, drug addiction. It really kind of like, I thought Holland was incredible. So I loved it. I highly recommend it. It's in theaters now and then it comes out on Apple TV Plus this Friday, the 12th. Yeah,
reminds me what a tremendous actor Tom Holland is. That kid's been on my radar. Forget about my obsession with Spider-Man,
The Impossible.
The Impossible.
His performance in The Impossible is unbelievable.
Which, if you've never seen, is on Netflix, and it's an incredible, 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 incredible film.
Yep, absolutely. Let's get to this week's blend game. We are playing. Okay, so this one is kind of open-ended, and is open to interpretation. And we are playing # Fantasy movie blend. So I'm going to go first and talk about the fact that I hate this genre. I'm not a fan of the fantasy genre. I get ripped on this show a lot for not liking Lord of the Rings. I'm just not a big fan of wizards and orcs and creatures like that. It just doesn't hold my interest. So I went through all of those and didn't pick any of them. But I think that I can get away with choosing Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Fantasy? I mean, feels like it's a fantastical world.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah? All right. I love
like
Willy
five
Wonka
people
and Chocolate
in
Factory.
One bed.
Yeah. That's what kind of fantasy is that? Is that
the
a fantasy
least
for
it's
you?
Absurd.
This is a defining film from my childhood. Like it's one of those movies that I watched a gazillion times growing up and didn't realize how great Gene Wilder was until, you know, I got older and sort of processed his performance.
Did you ever get to meet him?
No, never did. That'd be an amazing get. But you know, it's great how it breaks down the different characteristics of bratty kids. Mike TV and Veruca Salt, obviously, and the girl who chews the bubble gum and blows up like a blueberry. Like, it's a twisted, demented, like, you can tell how that movie had such an impact on Tim Burton. Like, there would be no Tim Burton if Willy Wonka didn't exist. And so it's kind of funny that he went around and remade it. I actually don't hate the Johnny Depp
version. That's so weird. I had this conversation with someone this morning. I also don't hate. I mean, granted, I would never. Yeah, because someone quoted this morning. A director that works at my station, like, good morning, sunshine. The world says hello. And I was like, did you just quote the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka movie to me? I'm with you. And then I also I would never put it on over the Gene Wilder version, but I also think that people overly hated it because of their affinity for the Gene Wilder version.
There's a handful of movies too that when you actually stop to think about them, you think like, who let you guys make this movie? And the Oompa Loompas are bizarre. Mm. And the way that they dispose of the children, like, Augustus falls into a thing of chocolate, a river of chocolate, and they ride that boat through the psychedelic tunnel. Like, there's a number of times you point at that movie and be like, this shouldn't have happened. And so I'm putting it fantasy for that reason, and that's my choice for
that's
fantasy
movie
blend.
That's a great choice. That's a really
Kev,
great choice.
Kev, where are you at with fantasy movie blend?
Yeah, I went with Return of the King, only because I just never seen anything like that film before. It was one of the first films I ever saw that genuinely made me cry because of the level of action and just scope that Peter Jackson brought to the screen. Just those epic sweeping shots of the battles and the orcs and just the... I had just never seen filmmaking on that scale with that type of effects, with that type of emotion after, you know, two films prior and just the whole journey. And I just absolutely love the cinematography in that series, the obviously Howard Shore's score. But there was that final battle in Return of the King is one of the most incredible. That's like a defining moment for my filmmaking fandom. Like it just changed everything. I'm not a Lord of the Rings book reader. I'm not like an obsessive with Tolkien. I'm just really more, it was more of what Peter Jackson brought to it. And I think what Peter Jackson's vision combined with that epic story, just never seen anything like it. And at the end of the day, while there was a fantasy element to Lord of the Rings, it was the human element that really kind of sustained, right? And I think the at the end of the day, Jackson never lost focus of the human story or the Hobbit story. Wait, whatever you want to refer to. Is a Hobbit a human? I don't even...
No, it's a Hobbit.
Yeah, but I mean, like...
There's
man, and then there's Hobbit. There's the world of men. Like the world of men got one of the rings, and then the hobbits got one of the rings. Like, there's men.
Or mother boxes.
Some okay,
mother
box. All right. Well, either way, I actually never pontificated on whether or not...
there's elves, there's dwarves, there's hobbits, yeah. There's man.
Yeah.
Did either of you interview Jackson?
Not for Lord of the Rings.
Not for any of the Lord of the Rings? I was wondering if you guys got Jackson.
I only did the first Hobbit junket. Kevin, did you ever... I know we both got him for Hobbits. World War I documentary.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
It was cool, too. Can I take 2 seconds? We did this great... They had this great setup for us, this set... Peter Jackson put together this amazing World War I documentary where he restored a lot of like old footage, and they put us on this great set where like he and myself or Kevin are sitting together, and then they had this tracking camera that went back and forth. So I originally was going to like ask for a picture with him, but then I realized like I have 6 minutes worth of like two shots of this camera moving back and forth as he and I are speaking.
Wow, that's awesome. That's fantastic.
That was really cool. Yeah, that's right. Return of the King. Yeah,
good pick. That's your favorite of the trilogy, Return of the King?
Oh, no question. Yeah, but you know, but I'm weird. I like Die Hard 3 more than Die Hard 1. I also like Indiana Jones 3 more than Indiana Jones 1.
Well, I think a lot of people would say Return of the King. I don't think that's necessarily an unpopular. I mean, it's the only it won Best Picture.
Most people say Fellowship or Two Towers. I think the general consensus on that.
We'll get to audience picks in a little bit, but looking at our interactions on social, it's pretty split between the three of them.
Interesting.
We've got mentions from all three.
Did anyone say none of them?
Sean.
You might have.
Jake, what's your pick?
Like Kevin, I chose Lord of the Rings, but I'm going with Fellowship. Fellowship is my favorite. Again, there are no bad Lord of the Rings movies. I would never knock Return of the King. I love Return of the King is a little too much action for me. I love the downbeats of Fellowship. I feel like for me, Fellowship was always kind of the most succinct movie. And that it had a nice balance of the downbeats and the action. And I also just happen to love all of them together. After, at the end of Fellowship, the downbeat that it ends on is that the Fellowship is broken and that they're all going in different directions. I like all of them together. But everything that Kevin said is absolutely spot on. That like the world building, the cinematography, the Shore score. I can't hear that Shire theme without just like my heart just feeling warmth. And just some of the best collection of casting, period. I mean, I really wish that we lived in a world where Ian McKellen had won that Oscar for playing Gandalf, because I think his casting as Gandalf is genius, but also Viggo Mortensen and Elijah Wood everyone in that movie is just perfect. And also, we compliment Nolan a lot for his practical effects, but I mean, the practicality, Daenerys loves it too, the practicality that Peter Jackson, you know, from using the gorgeous scenery of New Zealand to genuinely having thousands of extras go through an incredible makeup process so that he didn't have to use CGI armies if he didn't have to, which granted in some cases, obviously he did, but a lot of cases he didn't and they looked real. And it's, he brought a fantasy world to life, unlike anything I think we'll ever see. And Kevin, I don't know about you, but like, I remember like there was a 3-year period where one came out at the end of every December. Yep. And my parents would take me out of school early to go see it on opening day. They'd be like, okay, go get a couple of classes in and then we'll go to like the, you know, the 1 o'clock show or whatever. And it was amazing. And that 3-year stretch for me, it was eighth grade, freshman year and sophomore year. It was amazing. And I think, you know, we didn't get to experience, short of the re-release, we didn't get to experience the Star Wars trilogy, but we got to experience the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and that was a hell of an experience for me.
And personally for me, I actually, in as much as I love Star Wars, I personally love Lord of the Rings more because of how I experienced it.
Sure.
And I think a lot of it has to do with, like, I got to watch that in real time as it was released. So the anticipation, and I knew nothing about the books, so when I went and saw Fellowship and that cliffhanger, or when it ends, and you just wait that year, and it's like, oh my god, I cannot wait to see what's gonna happen. And then
I kind of wish that they didn't reveal in the Two Towers trailer that Gandalf came back, because I'm with you. I also didn't read the books, and I thought he was dead.
Yeah, and so like that.
And granted,
to me,
No.
But interestingly enough, I wonder if I was alive during Star Wars, if I'd feel differently about it. Like, just when I'm looking at my like scope of my fandom, it's like Lord of the Rings is so high up there for me because I got to experience it in real time, I guess, if that makes sense. But
you guys will get to relive something very similar to that beginning in December of 2022 when Avatar 2 lands in theaters. And then
you mean the soon to be the highest grossing film of all time,
and extends to Avatars 3, 4 and 5. I was writing an Avatar story the other day, and I realized that Avatar 5 has a December 2028 release date right now.
So the sequel to Avatar is like Inception style. So the human goes into the avatar, and then the avatar goes into another avatar. So we're going three level avatar deep.
Good.
And then we're just gonna keep going. There's like
time is gonna move slower with each run too.
So. On the sixth level, the person is like in 7 different avatars, and they have to like go back to the other.
Audience picks: Randy Buss went with probably the most classic of fantasy films of all time, The Wizard of Oz. Michelle Garrest, Matthew Henderson went with Pan's Labyrinth. Max Avery said The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. June A.D. went with Legend. Calvin Lee and a bunch of other people who I saw picked Coraline. I kind of wanted to do an animated film because I thought animation really captures fantasy better than live action does. But most of these picks are live action. Gregory D. Voigt went with The Chronicles of Narnia. Clint Tomerlin said Spirited Away. And an incredible number of picks went to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, as Gabe pointed out, to different installments of it. So much participation.
Before
this week.
We move on really quickly, I don't know. I was curious if you guys felt like I did in that any movie that took place in space, I removed from consideration. Before anyone messages me and says, like, why didn't you choose Star Wars? To me, that automatically makes it a sci-fi film.
Yes, there were a number of titles that I considered that I dismissed because they were more sci-fi than fantasy.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Yes. I was curious if you guys felt the same way.
For next week, reach out on Twitter or email us your picks at realblend@cinemablend.com using... It's funny that you say this, Gabe, because we are lost in a show right now that I'll explain in a second.
Oh, really? This was completely random.
Hashtag Stanley Tucci blend. We're going to be playing the films of Stanley Tucci. But what I would like to argue is that his CNN show where he eats his way through Italy is phenomenal. Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's essentially Guy Fieri, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, but with class. Like, it's Stanley Tucci.
What did Guy Fieri ever do to anyone?
Hey, so sweet guy. I actually love that show. I legitimately love that show.
And I like him. He raised, like $25 million quietly during the pandemic and didn't tell anyone about it for restaurant workers. So, like, he's always on my cool list now.
He's a legit good guy. Like, I don't mean to knock him, but I'm telling, I did not tell you guys how much I love this show because I just feel like an old man watching Stanley Tucci eat pasta in different places around Italy about the history of it.
Yeah, I would watch that.
Oh my god, he's so charming.
Wait,
and everyone loves him.
He just eating throughout. Why didn't they just call it the Hunger Games? No, I'm being serious. Like, literally, like that, it's that. Like a missed opportunity.
It really is. It's a CNN thing, and it's just called, I think it's just called Stanley Tucci in Italy or whatever it is. But they pick a different region, and he goes to it, and he goes into different kitchens, and he knows people all throughout Italy, and they take him around different places where you have to eat. And it's
you
just
know, Kevin's phenomenal. Right, though. It's a missed opportunity, because at the end of every episode, Sean, don't they make two kids fight to the death?
They do.
Now I'm in.
All right, we have a review this week. This one comes from Philippe Medina, and it's called, the subject is called It Finally Happened. I think that's really funny.
That's awesome.
All right, well, let's done. See. Hey, guys, I've known about this podcast for quite some time, as I've been a big fan of Jake's going all the way back to his Houston Chronicle days. Growing
hey,
up.
Wow. Oh, my God. That's
my. How many years time. Is that?
15 years ago. I stopped writing for the Chronicle 15 years ago.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Growing up, my family and I were always known, excuse me, as the movie buff family, as our parents made a point to show us films that were important to them or that they appreciated. There were a lot of musicals and military movies in our household. As I graduated high school, I attempted to begin a journalism degree so that I may one day review films like you all. Soon, I learned traditional school wasn't my cup of tea, and I subsequently submerged myself in a service industry career working around 90 to 100 hours a week. Shout out to my fellow restaurant workers. I went from the guy who saw 3 to 4 new movies a week and amassed a 956 DVD collection to the guy who maybe saw 3 to 4 new movies a year. 3 to 4 new movies a year. When COVID-19 shut down dining back in March, I was completely lost and had no idea what to do with spare time, let alone how to enjoy it. So I started your podcast from the very beginning. God, I apologize for that, man, because we are rough in the beginning. Yes, I've listened to every single word you all have published and have finally caught up. With each wow. new episode, I abided by your reviews and recommendations, watching the movies, whether new or old, so that I may catch up on the latest and greatest. It revived the young cinephile in me and brought me back a much-needed joy in my life. The only way I think the show could improve would be to bring back the guest hosts that you guys did back in the early days. You had one Latinx writer and one female writer, and that was the extent of your diversity. The show constantly brings up that much different movies will affect people in different ways, and as much as I love you four boys, I'm beginning to predict how each of you might feel about a certain film, since I know so much about you. And as a proud queer Latinx man, certain films like Spanglish or Weekend are films that I find incredible, but may not receive the recognition from you four straight white males, since you won't relate to them the way that I might. Perhaps this could be something addressed with the YouTube channel or even the premium shows. Regardless, I cannot thank you enough for producing this show. Sorry for being long-winded, but I wanted to let you know that Real Blend has helped me so much in this last year. At a time when we can be with family the way we want to, your bantering and arguing about movies made me feel right at home, since it's identical to the way my three brothers and I act when we debate movies. One minute we may be screaming at each other due to differing opinions, and the next minute we all crack up at a really bad pun. Additionally, you boys were literally with me every step of the way as I pounded the pavements for months and months in search of gainful employment. You'll never know how much your show has lifted me and helped me keep walking when I was at my lowest. Much love and continued success to you all from Philippe Medina. That is unbelievable. Thank you so much.
That is a greatest hits album of reviews that we've gotten.
It really is. That's beautiful. Thank you, Philippe. That's fantastic.
Very much.
I don't think anyone else should send any reviews after that one. That's going to be really tough to top. Our next premium episode is a surprise, meaning that Gabe hasn't made up his mind yet. So you guys will figure out what it is on Monday. Again, if you want to access our premium episodes, they are at bit.ly/realblendpremium. And in the meantime, if you want to follow us on social media until we are back at this again, we are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. We'll talk to you next week when maybe we can talk about a very special movie that we possibly have seen. Until then.
Hubie.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.